Good morning.
Good
morning. My name is Betty Wall, and I'm a member of Al-Anon. I belong to the Tolerance Al-Anon Family Group in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, and I attend every Sunday and Wednesday night, and more often when I can, but I try to always be there on Sunday and Wednesday night. That's really important for me because I never could carry through a commitment of any kind, so I have to have nights I go. I want to thank the board. Joe didn't thank him. I don't think he was glad to be here. I want to thank the board for asking us. We've never been to Monegal before, and I really like it, Jim. I haven't felt well since I've been here, so I've just got to rest. And I've already been crying this morning, so I wanted to bring a roll of toilet paper, and they wouldn't let me because I didn't have any cleaning. When Jim asked me a year ago to come, I think in about the next breath or the next day, Mickey asked me to speak somewhere next weekend, and I thought that was a real dumb thing to do, and I told him. And I really did. But when I came back, I started out with this sponsor that told me to do what I was asked to do. And then I got to thinking about it later, and I thought, well, you know, there must be a reason. And then I got to thinking, wonder what's going to happen to me in this next year. And I really need to be here this morning. I don't really need to start out this way, but this is, I guess, the way it's going to be. I ask God this morning to just make me comfortable in my skin, please, while I was up here, and let me say what He needs for us to hear. I'm sort of coming out, I think, of what I've been through, of something that has happened to me in the last year. I told somebody, they asked me, was I nervous? I feel like I've come home. I have not lost anything during this last year. I've not been able to read, and reading literature has been real important to me. I finally gave up and quit because when I read it, I don't get any. I mean, it just doesn't comprehend. So I've just been living, and I didn't realize till this morning what a miracle for me that is. I've just been slowly moving forward. A lot of you probably couldn't tell that I was going forward, but I've just been slowly moving forward all year. And I've been going to meetings, and I've been reasonably sane most of the time. And that's a miracle for me. That's a miracle for me. I'm pretty hard on myself if I'm not. I haven't sponsored as many people, and I haven't been all things to all people, so I've thought that I wasn't doing everything I should be doing this year. I judge myself pretty hard. I try not to judge you quite as hard as I judge myself. I qualify real well to be here. I have a lot of alcoholics at my house. I'm married to one. I have several children. I'm going to give y'all some facts so you don't have to sit there and figure, and because I catch myself figuring. And last Wednesday, I was 52 years old. If we live and make it till the 30th of August, we will have been married 27 years. Our oldest child lives in Washington State. He's career Navy. He is the one that is in Narcotics Anonymous, and he is 30. He'll be 32 years old his birthday. We have twins. They are boys. I've had a nosebleed this morning, too. I'm just having a big... I'll just do anything for attention this morning. the twins are boys, and one of them is in the program. He's the one that came up and played golf with his dad yesterday. He has a little over a year. in AA. Our daughter is 20. She was 20 this past year, and she's has 3 years in the program. Her birthday's April Fool's Day. We all, there's a lot of people in here remember when she went to treatment. I cried and squalled all over Rough River, didn't I? But thank God for the program. I could talk and I got through it. And it's wonderful today. They told me it was wonderful. It didn't feel wonderful that day, but it's wonderful now. And then we have another child, the other twin. He's a boy, and he is not in the program. He needs to be in our program, but he teaches me a lot. He's a wonderful kid, and he's been one of my greatest lessons, and I'll tell you more about him after a while. When the pupil is ready, the teacher appears, and most of the time he is my teacher. Especially this last year he has been. My father is an alcoholic. Probably not practicing now because he's probably afraid to. I haven't seen him in quite a while, but the court sort of forced him to not drink anymore, and he chooses not to see me, and I've been able to let that go, and I hope he's happy, and I'm willing, if God's ever ready to heal that, it would be wonderful. If not, I have lots of family, and today I have a father. I want to tell you today, I'll give you a little more background, but not much. I want to tell you what God has done for me, what he has done to me. There are people in this room that know what a miracle I am. I have been restored. I am not well, okay? but I have been restored. When my body is sick now, my soul and my mind and my spirit are not sick. I've not been unhappy all weekend because I had to lay down. It's just, I don't fight quite as hard physically as I used to. But it's wonderful to stand here and I know that people love me. We were talking about that at the meeting Thursday night. I never ever knew in my whole life that anybody loved me. They did things for me that I'm sure meant I love you, but I never felt that anybody loved me because I didn't know how to love anybody. And that's so wonderful to be able to feel loved. I was raised in a very abusive alcoholic home, and I always thought they didn't love me, and I was looking for some pictures for Joe the other day for they were going to run some baby pictures or something in the newspaper in their ad this weekend, and I found some baby pictures that I didn't realize Mother had given me not long ago. I must have been cherished when I was little. I had on the most beautiful handmade dresses, you could tell, and my hair was perfect, and it had little bows in it, and it looked like I must have been about 4 years old when I had this look on my face, and I told Joe, I said, it must have already happened then, because look at me. I was the saddest looking thing in the world. I was dressed so pretty, but I had this sad, sad look on my face. It's very interesting that I think my daddy must have been in really bad shape when he and my mother married. And I have a feeling that I was going to save everything and it didn't work. Just isn't it amazing how when you begin to come out of this, you can look at pictures and see that stuff. But I really know, after seeing those pictures the other day, how much she must have adored me. Hated my mother for years, but y'all have given that back to me. I love my mother as good as I can today. I mean, I let go of that longing, of that that we long for. So y'all have given that to me. I love my mother. She's a tough old bird, and she taught me how to survive, and I'm grateful for that. And she always did all those physical things for me. I had clothes, and I had food, and that came to me. God gave me that one day that I never felt that they were going to abandon me. I thought about these homeless children. I saw that on TV, and I thought, that's it. And I was healed after that, because I never, ever, no matter what was going on, ever thought that they wouldn't feed me or keep a roof over my head. And there are kids that'll never know that feeling today. So a lot of times you have to look for the stuff to be grateful for and to heal yourself. But it's here. It's all here. I have two sisters. I'm the oldest of three girls. I have two sisters. My middle sister needs this program so desperately. She is dry, and her husband will not allow her to come to meetings. She's been dry for probably almost 20 years. This is her seventh marriage, and I believe it's a very abusive marriage, and I think he would kill her. He has told her if she came to Alcoholics Anonymous, he would kill her. She's very sad. She looks much, much, much older than me, and I was so jealous of her. She was so beautiful, and she was the cheerleader, and my mother adored her, and she had black curly hair and black eyes, and I hated her all of my life. Because I was the oldest, and I had to keep house and iron, and I really was the maid around there, and it didn't make you feel too good, you know. And I look at that and I think, wow, look what happened to her, you know. And then my baby sister that I adored and helped raise has left, and I haven't seen her in quite a few years. She has, I think that was her way of coping with what was going on with our family. She just sold her house and moved and left no forwarding address. We all have to cope however we have to cope. And as long as I'm willing, that may be healed someday too, you know. But I was a good student. It was hard to study at my house because, as I said the other night, all I ever wanted when I got here was peace and quiet, because it was never quiet there. There was screaming and abuse going on all the time, and you had to hide and study. And I know today that I could have gotten a scholarship to go to college, but my mother and father didn't really believe in education, and they thought they had done well if we got out of high school, and I just wanted away from there. That's all I wanted was just, I knew if I got away from there, everything was going to be all right. And I read fairy tale books all the time, and I just knew someday that the prince was going to come and take me away. My son lives like that now. I get to watch myself on a daily basis. I think he's waiting for the prince to come and take him away too. Literally. He would laugh if he heard me say that too. But the prince, well, I guess I thought he came. I don't really think he was riding a white horse. On graduation night, I met this fella, and he just happened to say the right thing at the right time. In a day or two, he said, "I love you, will you marry me?" And I said, "Yes." You know, that was all. And I didn't love him. I didn't love anybody, you know. And only gift I got from him, and I hope he doesn't feel any animosity toward me today. I think I've made amends to him. I feel comfortable. I have three children by him. He's the boy's father, their biological father. And I got out of there as soon as I could. We were married almost 7 years, and it was horrible. I was too sick, you know. I know today that I was so sick then. And he was not an alcoholic. Interesting, isn't it? He was not an alcoholic. And I wasn't divorced too long till I was a hairdresser, and I was a very successful hairdresser. I had a great business. I was a good salesman. And if you're going to be a good hairdresser, you've got to be a good salesperson. I was good, and I made good money. I could take care of myself and the boys, but I was headed for destruction. I was drinking heavy, not sleeping, working all the time, and running with the horse show bunch. They had money, and I liked them. And I was young, and they liked me, and I was really headed for trouble. I was spiraling. There's a lot of people in Nashville, a lot of fellas that debate whether I'm an alcoholic or not, and I used to debate it. I read the big book till I found out who I was, and I'm very comfortable with that today. I'm in there. If y'all want to find me, read it. I ain't one. I was real close, but I ain't one. And I used to go in the back. I would be so hungover in the mornings. And I had an 8 o'clock appointment, but I was responsible and I liked money, so I would always be there. And I'd go in the back door after I got my first one. We didn't have blow dryers back then. We had to get them under the dryer. And I had a good shampoo girl, and she'd have them sitting in my chair waiting for me, and they'd all be watching the door. And I'd get her under the dryer, and I'd go in the back door of this little restaurant and get me something to eat. If I could get some food in there, I could get to moving after a while, you know. And I guess that's the morning he must have been sitting in there drinking coffee. I was probably moving pretty fast. I don't remember seeing him. But they asked the right questions. This friend of mine did when they asked me to go to the horse show. You know, because I thought, I'll go show my horsey friends a thing or two. And I did. And we went to the horse show, and as he told you last night, I just didn't get the drift of it. I mean, the bottle rolled down the thing, and I was trying to get the bottle and get it, and we did lose the car, and I'd never seen anybody drink like that. I didn't really know what was going on. I mean, I had drank, and I'd partied, and my daddy had drank, but I'd never really. So I couldn't figure out what was wrong. And the next day, we went to Center Hill to the lake, and everybody was just astounded. I thought he didn't drink the next day. So much of my life's blacked out, I don't know. They were astounded that he didn't have a beer in his hand, everybody we saw. But he did pass out on the gear shift. I had an awful time. We were driving my car that day, and I didn't think a whole lot about it again. I didn't participate in my own life a whole lot. Then I didn't participate in it at all. Just whatever happened, and I just did it, you know. I never stopped to think about any of that. And the twins were always hyper, and they're still sort of hyper. They laugh about the things they did, and even my mother. My mother used to tell me what a terrible mother I was, that I couldn't make these children do these things. And the twins just had a birthday this past Monday. They were 30, and I went to mother's. Mother had a birthday right before that, and one of the twins and I went up there, and she said, I don't know how you lived through them. You know, they were just wild. They were the wildest children. They just swung from the rafters all the time. They literally did. You could not sleep because you could not put enough locks on the door to lock them in. The milkman would bring them back home at 3 o'clock in the morning. And I had locks. There would be chairs stacked on top of chairs where they would get out. And then the oldest one would run away because he was real quiet and he couldn't stand them. They just drove him wild. And he was just 19 months older than they were. And he just, you know, and it was just wild all the time. And this one that had the broken collarbone would dive off of his top bunk. and break his collarbone all the time. And, I'd see him doing it, but I couldn't get there. And he'd holler, "Look, Mom," and you'd hear it crack. And I think he was in a cast this time, because around here, and you had to hold him for him to sleep. He couldn't lay down. And nobody really ever helped me with him, and I don't blame him. I wanted to. I never knew it was. We were talking, a girl I sponsor and I were talking the other day. I didn't know that you could leave. You know, people leave their children now. I didn't know that that was. I didn't know that was a choice, and it's a good thing I didn't, because I would have left. I thought you had to stay. I knew the daddies could leave. And she laughed too. She said it's a good thing she didn't know it was a choice, because she believed she would have left too. So it's only by the grace of God that I didn't know I had a choice that I stayed. And it was rough. But when he came over that, he had an office there in town, and he started dropping by. I think I fell in love with him instantly, as much as I knew what love was. And I know today it was because he reminded me of my grandfather, and that was the only person I'd ever loved in my whole life. And Joe still reminds me of my grandfather. He's the kindest, most loving person I ever knew. And I was mad at him for years and years for dying and didn't know I was, and leaving me. Until right before I came back into the program, I can remember stomping my foot in my den one day. Joe had done something that I didn't like. I stomped my foot and told my grandfather, "If you hadn't died and left me, nobody would have ever treated me like he's treating me." And that's probably the truth. You know, he would have saved me all my life, and I'd still be out there somewhere. But it was just a miracle to me that a man would sit down, because their father had never helped with them at all, that a man would sit down and hold that child. I didn't know he was drunk. Joe did not appear drunk. He was so far into the disease of alcoholism that he stayed like this all the time. And that's the only way I knew him. And he was funny. He was fun. And we went out and drank some. And he'd get a little too drunk, but I'd seen people get a little too drunk before. He got to staying all night. And these young people call these, he hates for me to say this, but it's true, it's the way I was raised. These young people call it a meaningful relationship. Well, that is not what they called it 27, 28 years ago. They called it shacking up. Y'all know they did, don't you? And it wasn't very acceptable, and I was afraid my mother would hear about it, and I didn't want to listen to her mouth. And he had this bright red Oldsmobile, and I didn't have a garage, and you couldn't hide it. So he was either going to have to leave, or we were going to have to get married. And I didn't want him to leave, and he wasn't going to leave, but he didn't want to get married. And it used to make me so angry when he talked from the podium and said that I kidnapped him, but it didn't work. I was off on Tuesday, so I got dressed and went down to the office and told him we were going to go get married. Caught him at the service station, and we didn't go that day. But the next Tuesday, we did. And I don't think I even told anybody. And that's how much I participated in my life, except when I went by my grandmother's house and told her and asked her for her wedding ring to get married in, and she gave it to me. It had her and my grandfather's initials in it, and I wore it for years and years, and I still have it, and it's priceless to me. But we got married, and by the next morning, I really knew what alcoholism was. I didn't know what it was, but I went to work and I didn't tell anybody that I got married, because Joe came home and went to bed, and it probably was weeks before he came out of the house. After I got to this program and found out what alcoholism was, I know today that he was a daily binge drinker. He drank every day. And every 90 days, he got on a binge, and He would be in the bed, and he would become almost an animal before he sobered up. He never shaved, he never bathed. And somehow he would get to the bathroom and he didn't look like anybody that I even recognized. He told you he's blind in one eye and that eye would completely close and the muscles in his face would droop, and I was terrified. I was terrified. And so I would just freeze myself till that was over. And he lived through it, and I wouldn't tell anybody. And then he would come out of it and he would be remorseful. And he would drink again, but I could live on the remorse until it happened again. And we got into this side, and I would run him off, and he would come back, and I would run him off, and I had filed for a divorce 2 or 3 times. I couldn't, and he would come back, and he'd say, "I won't drink," and y'all know that whole story. And we went to, I went to that meeting with him that night, and I thought, oh boy, this is it. That was about a little over 25 years ago. I guess it would be almost 26 years, I guess. I'm a watcher, aren't I? I still can see that, and it's so wonderful. I don't know anything they said, but I can remember. I worked late that night, and I thought everybody in the shop was trying to help me get through because they knew I wanted to go because this was going to heal everything. They were all, everybody was helping, And got out of there, just as we went to Murfreesboro. That's where I went to my very first meeting. I find I've come full circle now. But I can still remember you went in there, and I could see all that laughing and the coffee bar, and I just couldn't wait to get back there. I could see all those people, all those men. I just loved men. I didn't trust women. Didn't even like them. But they pushed me in this door, and they said, "Honey, you go in there." And I thought, they just don't understand, because I needed to see what he was going to do. Because how could I know what to do if I didn't see what he was going to do? They pushed me in there. And that was I got a little tiny piece of information that night that has been dangerous for many years for me. I found out that very night that my daddy was an alcoholic and that my husband was an alcoholic. That was the most relieving thing I ever heard in my life. And I cried the whole meeting because I thought that they were just no good and sorry. That's what I'd heard my mother say. I thought they were sorry and no good, but they told me they were alcoholic and they could be better, and I thought, this is wonderful. This is wonderful. I know what's wrong with them now, because I'd tried everything. Now I knew what was wrong, and I could fix it. That's so dangerous. And I just loved Alcoholics Anonymous. I still get chills when y'all read how it works. I'll never forget the first open AA meeting. I thought I'd died and gone to heaven. And I'd love to hear Rufus talk, and I just love to hear him read how it works. I just sit there. I was just enthralled with Alcoholics Anonymous. But they said I was supposed to go to Al-Anon, so I went. I just couldn't wait till Saturday night when they had speaker meetings. And I was just enthralled. And I didn't like women. I didn't like women. I didn't trust women. Well, I was the most untrustworthy person in the world. And I know today that that's why I didn't trust women. And I used to say, if you wanted a good friend and you needed a man, tell him something and he wouldn't tell it. I know today they gossip worse than we do. I tell everything. But we went, and I was in a blackout. I was just in a blackout. I didn't get anything. I got enough to live on and know. A lot of the daily drinking stopped. I don't remember a lot. I know that we still had a lot of binges. And I still thought if he could get sober, we could be happy. And I didn't know I was so sick. I never heard it. I couldn't hear it. I just couldn't hear it. And life just went on and it went on and it went on. And I was so sick that Joe used to make me stay in my room in the morning. I screamed at the children so bad he'd make me stay in my room till he would get them off to school, and then I was allowed to come out. Wasn't anything wrong with me, though, you know. I mean, by the time I had him throwing up, I did. I had him throwing up every morning, and the kids crying, and it was awful. I was just wild and full of rage and didn't know it. And I don't know how, you know, it's a miracle that they love me at all today. It's just a miracle. It's just a miracle that any of them ever come to see me. And I used to think I was so wonderful and I had all the answers and they should be so blessed because I stayed with them. And I read something in the Al-Anon literature that said we're pretty lucky that they stayed till we got better, and I'm one of those that's real lucky that they even come around and acknowledge me today, because I wasn't a very nice person to live with. Joe told you a lot of things that happened to us last night. He did become very successful, and I always thought that money would ease that hole, that awful hole I had. I couldn't go to church because I'd been, that's a piece of background that's real important that I need to tell y'all. I don't want to knock churches and I don't want to knock any religions, but I need to tell you where I came from. I was raised in the Church of Christ. All I ever heard them say, I used to say what they said, all I ever heard them say was that if I wasn't good, that I was going to hell and I was going to burn for eternity. And I was full of myself and still am. And I tried so hard when I was a little girl to be good. And my mother would always tell me, you just can't be good. And by the time I was 7 or 8 years old, I knew I was going to burn in hell for eternity. Because I could not make it all day and be good. And every morning I'd get up and I'd think, all right, today I'm going to make it all day and I'm going to be good. And I thought good was perfect. And so I judged myself against perfection. And every time I judge myself against perfection, I fall very, very short. And that's where I was coming from. And so I just had to give all of that up. And through this period, I stayed around Al-Anon for a long, long time. And I just couldn't get it, but there was a period in there that I started searching churches, and boy, I went from here to here. I got as charismatic as you could get. But it kept me alive. It kept me alive because I could feel it while I was there. But it didn't sustain me at home. It was their God and your God, and I could never have that. I could never be worthy of that. I just didn't know how to do it. I just didn't know how to get it. But I could go often enough that I could live off of that. And most of my children are spiritual because I don't know where they got it. Most of them are spiritual, though. Joe traveled a lot, and he was gone a lot, and the boys were gone, and there was nobody home but me and Susie, and we had a beautiful home. And when I look back now and think about those fairy tales, the prince really came. All my dreams really came true. I had all the things that you could ever want. I had a beautiful Mercedes Roadster, and I always wanted a convertible. And I lived in the hills where you could drive through the hills and just... I didn't have anybody to have anybody. I had isolated myself so in this house. When we bought it, we bought it after Joe had had that surgery because it was old and we redid it and we bought it really cheap. But I drove up the driveway, across the creek and up the driveway, and I knew it's where I'd always wanted to be. I didn't know then that what I'd always wanted was total isolation. And that's where I lived. I lived that way for about probably 7 or 8 years. And I didn't come to Al-Anon those 7 or 8 years. And I could highly recommend that for somebody if they'd make it back, because I got sick enough in those 7 or 8 years that I crawled back in here. And I think about this lady that when I crawled back in that meeting that day called me a damned old retread, and she made me so mad that I got better. But I was sitting there one night, and there was nobody there. Susie was 13, I think, by this time, and she had explained to me one night that I was trying to live my life through her, and I heard her whisper to one of her friends on the phone, "I'd like to go to the movie with you, but I hate to leave Mom here. She's by herself all the time. You know, she doesn't have any friends." And I didn't. If you can do that, if you can finally get yourself in isolation, you don't have to explain to anybody what's going on anymore. It's real peaceful. It's real peaceful. Then if you can kill all the feeling that you have, you don't have to hurt anymore. And I did that. There was no pain anymore. But I didn't realize you could kill the pain. When you killed that, you killed everything. You killed the joy. Killed everything. And I really wanted to not be here anymore. But I didn't want to kill myself. Because I didn't know how to kill myself. But I just didn't want to be here. I just didn't want to be here anymore. And I didn't want to wake up in the mornings. And I was sitting out by the pool one night, and we had the most beautiful pool, and I'd always wanted a pool, and we looked like we lived in a resort. We had these colored lights in the trees and colored lights in the pool, and the most beautiful flowers. Joe loves flowers, and we had the most beautiful flowers, and I was just sitting out by the pool, and I thought, well, I'll go swimming. And I thought, it's pretty dangerous. There's not a soul in the world around. I thought, well, I won't do that. And I thought, well, I'll put the top down on my car and go over to the park and ride through the hills and the woods. And I thought, well, you know, that's not real smart either. I thought, I'll go inside and watch TV. I'll go inside and do something. Well, the house had just been totally redone, and there wasn't anything to do, you know, and I never cooked when they weren't home, so there was nothing to do. And I thought, well, I'll watch TV, and I flipped through, and there was something real funny on. And I turned it on, and I sat there, and I couldn't laugh. And that was one of the saddest nights. I probably hit my bottom that night and didn't know it. It wasn't but a few nights after that till a friend of Joe's called and told me how concerned he was about Joe. I knew that Joe kept a lot of cash on him, a lot of cash, and he probably kept a gun in the glove box of the car. And this man wanted to tell me what he had seen him do that day or a day before that. And he said, "What are we going to do about him?" And I said, "I don't know." I said, I don't know anything to do anymore. I just don't know. And he said to me, and I'd never thought of this, he'd been in the program. And I don't know where Chuck is today. I think he's a cocaine addict. I think he was using cocaine at that time. And I find this real interesting that God will, don't ever disregard the messenger, just listen to the message. Because Chuck said to me, you know what you need to do? You need to go back to Al-Anon. And I'd never thought of it. I'd never gotten anything from Al-Anon. I didn't even know what Al-Anon was, really. But I went. It took me about 3 weeks to go back. I went on the other side of town from where I used to go to a daytime meeting because I didn't want to see anybody I knew. And this old lady met me at the old blue-haired lady. They're going to call them old yellow-haired ladies. I told them in my group the other day, a few years down the road, because we all get yellow hair now, Juanita. They'll say, them old yellow-haired ladies. This old blue-haired lady was standing at the top of the steps, and she said, come on up. I got to the landing. You had to go up 3 flights of steps, and I got to the landing. And I thought, there's no use in me doing this. It's just too late. It's just too late. I can't ever feel, I don't know what I thought. I just couldn't, I was defeated. And she walked on down those steps, and I thank God for her. We had a lot of, we don't agree on anything, that old lady and I don't. But she was there for me that day. And God, I thank God for her. She walked on down and took me by the arm and took me to the meeting. And I went in there and I didn't know that I guess I'd really taken the first step before I got there and didn't know it. I never had a sponsor. I never worked any steps. My husband just couldn't get sober, and I just couldn't stand it. I'm not sponsoring a girl like that today, and she nearly drives me crazy, but I need her. She just can't get the picture. Her husband just can't get sober, and she can't stand it, and she's been around a long, long time, 15 years, I think. And I hurt for her, but I can't give it to her. And they said, are there any newcomers here? And my little hand went up. And I'm so grateful for that. And they said, well, we want you to go. And Joanne hates this, but I needed it. You always remember this, okay? They may have done this just for me, because I'd never heard it before. We didn't used to do that. And they said, we want you to go to 6 newcomers meetings. And I said, okay. And I got up and went in that room and I sat down. I had no need to tell anybody that I'd ever been here before. I sat down and I just listened. I just listened. And they told me, and I didn't know anything, and that was so wonderful. They told me that after my 6th meeting, I could go back out in this big room. And I was really excited. And they let me straighten up. They told me I wanted out of there when the meeting was over. I was in such bad shape that all I did was go to the grocery store and the dry cleaners, in such bad shape mentally. I couldn't remember what time the meeting was, and it was at 1 o'clock, but I couldn't remember, so I'd just get there at various times and just sit down in this room and just wait for somebody to get there. Sometimes I'd get there, one day I got there at 10:30. So that's why I tell you that I'm a miracle standing up here. I guess I know that God took me to those meetings. I went in the daytime because I didn't want Joe to know that I was going. because I knew that if I told him, I always had to tell him what I was doing. I knew if I told him that I couldn't do it, and I couldn't do it for me. And so I went in the daytime. And after they told me to, the chairs were set up, I think, like this when we got there, and they set them up in a circle. This was a great big meeting, about 100 people. And they didn't have meetings that big when I'd gone before. And when it was over, after I got to go back out to the big room, this gruff lady, I just couldn't stand her, would say, "Put them chairs back like they were when you got here, honey." I thought, I don't reckon she knows who she's talking to, that I'm a very affluent lady, and she drives this old beat-up car, and I don't guess she knows, but I put them chairs back in place. And there was this other little lady, I know today they were picking at me, this other lady that said, "That one right back there's not straight, honey." And I thought, well, you old, I'll go straighten that chair. And then one day they said, "You know, all this literature has to be put up over here," and the literature person left, "and you could get over here and help us put this up." Well, I know today what they were doing. I thought they were the hatefulest bunch of old women. And then I heard them talking about this. It was so long from Wednesday to Wednesday. It was just so long. And I heard them talking about a step meeting. And I thought, dare I ask them? Because I was afraid. I'd never been afraid of anybody in Al-Anon before. I want you to know that. And I said, "What are y'all talking about?" And they said, "We have a step meeting here at 10:30 on Monday morning." And I said, I was so ignorant, it was pitiful, but it was wonderful. It was wonderful. Because I'd just say whatever was in my little head, and I said, "Well, would you let me come?" And they said, "Well, yes." I don't guess anybody ever asked permission to come. And I came, and then I really couldn't keep the times of the meetings. And this little old gruff lady wrote it on a piece of paper for me. And you think I'm not a miracle? She had to write Monday 10:30 and Wednesday 1 o'clock. And we put it in my ODAT book. And so I started coming to the Monday morning meeting. And I couldn't hear anything they said. I still couldn't hear anything anybody said. And I sat like this. And I watch people today when they come in meetings. I sat like this and I held. I know today that I was just trying to hold on and keep it all in here so it wouldn't fly out the window somewhere, wherever. And there was still nothing in here anywhere, just nothing. But those little ladies were there. And I thought, I can live till Monday. I couldn't wait to get there to see them. There weren't but about 6 or 7 of us, I don't think. And sometimes I'd sort of just blurt out something in the meeting. If I came to one of y'all's meetings today, as sick as I was then, y'all would probably form a committee to take me off to the side somewhere. Really, I think about that. We had one that came in blubbering and blurting the other night, and they were ashamed of her. I could tell they were ashamed. She was in such bad shape, I was afraid she might hurt one of us physically, but I don't think they ever thought about that. They just didn't know what to do with her, and I thought, I try to tell them all the time, but they don't believe me. They don't believe that I was in that kind of shape. We were sitting there one day. We were all there, and they were having a step meeting. I was just there, and I blurted out. Tears started to unfreeze that morning. Tears started running down my face. And I looked up at them and I said, "Could some of y'all help me?" And they just stopped the meeting and they said, "Honey, what do you want?" And I said, "I don't know, but could you just help me? I wonder what we would do in the middle of a step meeting if I wonder what I would do if somebody did that. Man, I come up so short sometimes. And they said, let us give you our numbers. And I said, I can't keep up with them. I'll lose them. And they took my ODAT book and they wrote their numbers in there. And I still have them. I've just been crying all morning before I started talking, and I'm going to just keep crying. And they said, you've got to start calling us. You've got to have some help, and you've got to call us. And I thought, I didn't understand that. But I was really, really hurting. When I got home from the meeting, I tried to call, sometime that afternoon, I tried to call the first number on there. Nobody answered. And I called the second number, and this lady answered, and I couldn't figure out exactly which one she was. But I just loved talking to her, and I could remember that she was the second person on that list. And I thought, maybe when I go back to the meeting, I can listen to their names, and I could figure out which one she was, because she had the sweetest voice. And she was so kind to me, and she asked me questions about myself. And she really acted like she wanted to talk to me. I was sitting at a meeting. Would y'all believe it was that gruff old lady? I was afraid of her, and she wanted to hug me. And she hugged so hard, and I was so skinny. I'm fat. Fatter than I've been in years right now. I was so skinny, it hurt my little bones when she hugged me. And I just thought, oh. And she talked about God all the time. And I thought, this lady is a religious freak, I guess. I don't know what's wrong with her. And it was God this and God that. And they'd say, are you going to be at the meeting tonight? Well, if God's willing. And I thought, well, don't you know whether you can come to the meeting tonight or not? And I'd go home from, and she'd say, call me. And I thought, well, this woman just really likes me. She wants to talk to me about something. And I'd go home and call her so I could do her a favor, you know. She thinks this is so funny today. She didn't really know what was going on then. And I just loved to talk to her on the phone, and I was I hated it when I had to sit in a meeting with her. And today I know, and I just started pouring my heart out about my whole life on the telephone to her. And today I know that I was talking to God. Oh. And she'd say God in meetings, and she'd, until I just thought I was going to die. And she told me one day, she said, I've got something I need to tell you. And she said, I want you to meet me over at the at Radnor Lake. There are a few people in here that know how busy Radnor Lake is, and you know, the people from Nashville can really appreciate this. It's a beautiful, it's in the center of town. It's just gorgeous. It's just a retreat, and you're not allowed really to eat back there, and the animals are, and there's a lake back there, and it's all preserved, and they have trails, and she loved it. She was an outdoorsy person, and I didn't really like all that kind of stuff. But she said, meet me over there. Well, we got in the parking lot. She said, I have something I wanted to tell you. And see, I had some secrets that I never had gotten rid of, and they were haunting me. And I knew I needed to tell them to her, but I was really afraid because this woman paid attention to me, and I didn't think she would like me at all. And we got in that parking lot, and she said, now I've got something I need to tell you. There was people coming in and out of there. You know, they parked their cars, and we got right there on the trail. She said, and kneel down here. We're going to pray before we go back there. And I said, we're going to what? And we kneeled down there, and these people were walking. And y'all can't imagine. Yeah, y'all can't imagine how hard that was. But I was afraid to not do it. Isn't that wonderful, that wonderful fear we have? I was afraid to not do it. I was afraid she'd go away. And I wanted her to go away. That was what was so. It's like, go away and leave me alone. We went back there, and she did a wonderful thing for me, and I've been able to do this for people I sponsor. It opens them up. She told me her secret before I was ever even took the third step. And I told her my secret that I'd carried for so long. And it really freed me. It really freed me. I could not let Joe go, though. I just could not. He was the God of my understanding. He had fixed everything. If he didn't fix it, he knew somebody that could fix it. He was just everything I'd ever wanted, except he wouldn't do exactly right. If I could just get all of him lined up, I mean, he had all of the potential and all of the credentials and all, but I couldn't get it in line all at once. But he never had let me down in a lot of ways, and he was the greatest God I'd ever known. But those human gods have clay feet. They do have clay feet. Did you get that on tape, John? And they do let you down. They can't help it. They do let you down. But all day this day, it was July the 26th, 1986. All day long, I called Lucy. And I was in really bad shape. And all she would say to me, "You gotta let Joe go, Betty. You just gotta let him go." And I'd say, "But I'm afraid if I let him go, I'll lose him." Isn't that funny that we think we're holding? I don't know what we think. I was just so sick, that's what I thought. I was afraid if I let go, what would happen? Well, hell, it was happening anyway, you know. But it was awful, and I'd call her back and she'd say, "Betty, let him go." I'd say, "I don't know how." She'd say, "Get on your knees and let him go." I'd say, "But what's going to happen then?" And she was, a lot of you know her, she's a woman of few words. And at 2:30 in the afternoon, beside of my wingback chair, I got on my knees and I said, "God help me." I used to didn't talk about this, and I've robbed God by not talking about it. I had the most beautiful spiritual experience. I was bathed in warmness. That hole was filled up. I got up and went and washed the dishes. And I never felt so comfortable in my whole life. And nothing's ever been the same since. There's been a lot of work between July the 26th, 1986, and today. But I knew without a shadow of a doubt that everything was going to be all right. Didn't make any difference what happened. I was going to be all right, and I wanted to live. And I feel like that no matter if I'm about to throw up when I wake up in the morning, I still feel bathed. And I've had a lot of spiritual awakenings. I get them on a regular basis. A lot of stuff has happened since then. I really think I know what my intentions were. I knew that I had to get enough recovery and enough peace of mind and enough strength to leave my husband, that I could no longer live that way. I didn't find it necessary to tell him that. I became kind and courteous. I started ingesting literature. I had read it all those years. I started putting it back in. And it was like I no longer had to put the bicycle together without the instructions. I read the literature. It told me to be courteous, and I was courteous. If I come to you today, this is a gift I know. If I come to you today and ask your help, I will try with all of my heart to do what you tell me to do. Or there's no sense in me wasting your time or my time to come and ask you. I went to the dentist the other day and had to have a crown. They told me to floss, so I flossed really good. They told me I could cut back just a little bit. I flossed to fill and clear out. They said I could slow down just a little bit. But I went to a lady dentist, and I'm just crazy about her. She's real young. And when she finally got my new crown, she was taking off my temporary, and she said, "God, this temporary looks just like it did the day I put it on." And I said, she said, "What have you done?" And I said, "You said brush it first, floss it first, and don't chew on it." I said, "That's what I did." She said, "But nobody ever does what I tell them to do." I said, "Well, this crown cost $500, and you said to do that, and I did it." And she was astounded. Y'all taught me that, though. God gave me that day, gave me a lot of gifts. And I learned how to live with alcoholism. I'm grateful that Joe was, I hate it for him, but for me, I'm grateful I came back while he was still actively drinking. And I learned to be kind and courteous to him while he was drinking. And the night that I knew I was going to be a little better was my birthday. And I love flowers too. And the only friends I had were at H.G. Hill, the grocery store there in Brentwood. And whoever was working at the dry cleaners, because they don't get real personal with you, you know. And the girls in the flower department would hug me, and I was always picking at them. And and I didn't feel good, and I was laying on the sofa, and I heard Joe pull in, and it was about 10 o'clock. And I just sort of tried to play like I was asleep. That's what I sort of did at that time, because I didn't want to look at him to see how much he'd had to drink. And I had to do just sort of whatever I had to do it then. And I could hear him coming in and whispering to Susie. And I finally had to sort of sit up and see what was going on. And he just kept bringing flowers. He kept bringing flowers. I mean, baskets. And cut arrangements. And potted flowers. And he drove this great big Mercedes. And I think it was as full as they could get it. He had stopped at H.G. Hill's, my store, and bought everything I guess they had, and they'd all helped him load it. And he meant for me to wake up the next morning and see these everywhere. And, you know, for the first time, I thought he was a little amusing, just a little. Not much, okay. And then I thought, oh, God, where am I going to go to the grocery store? Because I can't go back in there. They might say something to me. And it was like I knew I had to go back there. And I went and I thought, well, maybe they won't say anything. And I was checking out, and this girl said, I wrote a check, which was, she said, "Oh, Mrs. Wall," she said, "you are the one, your husband was in here the other night." And I thought, yeah, he sure was. She said, "He is," and he was very inebriated. She said, "He is the cutest thing." I thought, well, I never thought of it quite like that. She said, "We all think that was the cutest thing, that he bought all of those flowers for your birthday. We had more fun loading them in the car. And see, all I'd ever seen was a drunk. And they saw that he was wonderful, and he was bringing me a carload of flowers. And how they wished they had somebody that would do that." And I began to try to see that. I began to look for that. And it became, when you begin to look for it, it becomes very apparent. About the time that I thought that I was really getting this stuff together and moving forward, and maybe I would I didn't know how I'd ever support myself, and I figured I'd probably have to leave our daughter because he knew a lot more people than I did, and he'd never let me have her. But I was willing to walk away and do that too. I just wanted freedom. I just wanted to be free of whatever it was. Of course, you know, he came back to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was never so angry. I was just never so angry. And I called my sponsor and I said, he's going to sober up. What in the hell am I going to do? I don't know how to do this. I said, I can't stand it. I've been there before. And she said, you don't have to go there again. She said, you go get living with sobriety. I said, what am I going to do? She said, exactly the same thing you've been doing every day. It doesn't make any difference whether he's sober or he's drunk. He ain't none of your business, honey. She said, you mind your own business. And I was afraid not to, so I did. I read Living with Sobriety, and if you've got a problem with somebody, pick it up and read it. It tells you everything you'd like for somebody else to do. You do it first. And I try to do that today. You know, I believe that courtesy breeds courtesy and honesty breeds honesty. If I want the people in my meeting that I go to be honest with me, I've got to be honest with them. If I want them to be courteous to me, I've got to be courteous to them. And the same thing happens at home. I got two little stories I need to tell you. I'm talk too long for me. I need to tell you how I found the God of my understanding. I took the third step and turned my will and my life over to a God I did not understand. Only God I ever knew was that vengeful God that kept a list. And Joe talked about all the other children last night, and we got back to the room, and he said, Betty, I didn't even talk about Tim. And I said, well, he's the other twin. And I said, there's probably a reason for that. I get to talk about him tomorrow. He's my teacher. Tim left home under really bad circumstances. Tim was always a problem child. From the time he was born, with a breech, with a broken arm, and he cried a lot. I held him more. I loved on him more. He just was troubled when he was born. He was just always a troubled child. And we had a hard time getting... We went to psychiatrists. We went to psychologists. He always was a behavior problem. I worked with the teachers and the principals, and we got him through school by the grace of God. He didn't get in a whole lot of trouble. But you know, Tim is gay, and I think I've known probably since he was 11 or 12 years old that he was. That was not acceptable to me. If you were not perfect, you were not acceptable to me because I thought I was perfect. And so I ignored it. I just ignored it. We all ignored it, I think. My housekeeper sat me down when Tim was about 19 and told me she thought it was time. She'd raised them, too. She said, I think it's time that you straighten up and realize that your child is gay. Just broke my heart when she said those words out loud because I knew it was true. And by that time, that wasn't as much of a problem as his lifestyle was. He was, he tells me now that he was just coming out of the closet then and he was wild. He was picking up everybody in every bar in Nashville and slipping them in the house. And Joe was on the road a lot, and I became afraid of Tim because he used to tell my mother, he adored me. He used to tell my mother that he wished that his daddy would die and his brothers and his sister would die so there would be nobody in the world but me and him, and then I would love him and he could love me. Oh, and that frightened me. I had enough sanity to know that that was very dangerous. And we asked him to leave, and we finally had to put Tim out. And Joe told you last night, they got so wild and so crazy that he finally put him on a bus with a gun. We didn't hear from Tim for about a year. I used to just pray for him. I wasn't in the program, and I didn't do any of this in the program. So it was very painful. For a year, I didn't know whether he was alive or dead. And then he called me one time from California, and I began to hear from him a little bit. A year after I surrendered, my father shot my mother, and she's alive today, and I don't want to go into that. But they got a divorce, and Tim came home. I made sure he had a round-trip ticket because I didn't think I could live with him. But he did come home and stayed a week, and it was not easy for me because he's got a bad mouth on him, you know. But I was having a hard, hard time understanding or finding God. And I was standing in my kitchen one morning, and it had a lot of glass in it, and I was real troubled about Tim, feeling a lot of guilt and wishing I could help him. And I had this vision. And I was standing there thinking I'd just do anything if Tim would just be willing to help himself a little bit. And I had this vision. It was like I was standing there, and Tim was on the other side of that glass. And he walked up and knocked on the door, and I went over and opened it, and he looked me square in the eye. This vision was just as real as if he was standing out there. He looked me in the eye, and he said, "Mom, I'm home." And I hear that you found a way to live, and it works. And he said, "I'm willing. If you will teach me, Mom, I'll do anything that you tell me to do if I can just get better." And I thought, wouldn't that be wonderful? And at that very minute, that was me out there and God in here. And I knew exactly who God was. And I'd always wanted a father so, so bad. And that very minute I had one, and Tim gave him to me. And it was just a wonderful, wonderful thing. And that was probably in late part of 1986. Am I out of time? I'll be through in a minute. And last year, Tim would call at least once a month, and that always made me feel comfortable because I knew he was okay. And a lot of times I knew he didn't have a place to live, and he no longer demanded anything. He didn't demand that we send him money. I had to quit. Sometimes I would send him money and little gifts when it made me feel better. And he was living in Las Vegas at this time and doing his thing, you know, just doing his thing. He didn't call me on Mother's Day last year. He didn't call me on my birthday, which is the 28th of April. And I thought, that's a little strange. But I thought maybe he's just, you know, he may not have a place to live. That happened to him sometimes. And then he didn't call me on Mother's Day, and I was really a little concerned. And then he called me in about a week, and he said, "I'm sorry I didn't call you." His birthday is the 3rd of May. And he said, "I'm sorry I didn't call you on Mother's Day. I haven't felt good." And I said, "What's wrong, honey?" He said, "I think I have the flu, Mom. I just don't feel very good. I don't feel like working right now." I'm real dense. I thought he meant right now, today. And we chatted for a while, and he seemed okay to me. And in about 3 days, he called back, and he said, he lived with this old man that's about 60. His name's Jerry. Cleaned that up good, didn't I? His name is Jerry. Jerry had been arrested, and Tim was fixing to be evicted. Jerry had been arrested for soliciting a minor. And Tim was fixing to be evicted, and he kept talking, and I was cooking dinner. And I finally pulled it out of him. We had talked about AIDS, and we talked about HIV, and I'd ask him to be careful, and I would ask him periodically if he was being tested, and he was always real nonchalant about it, and he would tell me, "This can't happen to me, Mom. I'm invincible," he'd say. "You know, I've been through everything." And I pulled it out of him, and I said, "Honey, I'll have to call you back after a while. I can't talk right now." And he said, "Please don't cry, Mama." He said, "I wish I could have not had to tell you." He was going to try to do it by himself. He didn't want to hurt us. Whew. You know, I've felt some pain in my life, but I don't think I ever felt my soul hurt before. And that was in June of last year, I guess. I've never wanted to quit going to meetings, and I went to hospice the next day, and man, they weren't what I wanted that day. They didn't even want to talk to me. But I knew enough to start talking to y'all, whether you wanted to hear it or not, you know. A lot of people didn't want to hear it. They didn't want to talk to me. But I just really didn't care. Oh. I went to my meeting and told it, and they looked at me like, "You ought not to be talking about this here, honey." And I thought, well, you know, I cannot keep anything inside of me anymore. I can't live. I just can't do it anymore. Y'all told me I didn't have to do that anymore. We brought him home. I guess it was the middle of July. He'll be here a year in July. And we couldn't get it, you know, we didn't want to bring him to the house because we'd had such a bad experience when he left under such terrible circumstances. But we brought him to the house the night we went to the airport to pick him up. And we shipped a lot of his stuff home. And night we went to the airport to pick him up, Joe was so good to me. Everybody's been so good to me. I had a month almost before he got there, and I cried for a month. I've never cried like that. I was raised on a farm, and I can remember Daddy selling the calves and having to listen to the cows cry all night. And I used to think that was the most horrible sound I ever heard in my life. And that's the way I cried for about a month. But I know today that I let go of him dying before he ever got home so we could live. And he's doing wonderful. They told me if I could get him home and feed him and love him. He has his own apartment, and he's still doing his own thing. Somebody, some kind soul that in the program told me they thought I ought to let go of him living. I'd been able to let go of him dying, and now I ought to let go of him living. And so I let go of him living. And he has a wonderful attitude. And we'll just do whatever we have to do. And, y'all taught me that alcoholism is not a disgrace, it's a disease. And I thank God for that, because I knew immediately that HIV and AIDS was not a disgrace, it's just a disease. And I knew how to handle it. Oh. And that's the way I've done it. Oh. And I've talked way too long. I try to not ever talk this long. There's a lot of other stuff I wanted to say, but I guess I said exactly what I needed to say. And I'm a lot better, and this is... I really feel better. I'm coming out of whatever it is I've been doing last year. I've been moving, like I told you, slowly forward, but I'm getting a lot better now. Oh. And I thank you for having me. I hope that somebody has gotten something. I feel a lot better, and I know I needed to be here. And I love all of you, and thank you.